WWE is the standard setters. They have the best wrestlers. Now, you could say that's an opinion. And I prefer a different style of wrestling. Okay, you have the right to that opinion. But I can tell you from being in the ring with these guys that once I went to WWE, I noticed right away the skill level, the well-roundedness, the talent of the wrestlers in WWE, way above where I had been before. And many of you noticed in my matches right away that my matches were better, but you couldn't put your finger on why they're better. I'm telling you, it's because I'm swimming in a different pool. Some of the other guys, their achievements are not as grand. The stars that they have wrestled are not as well-rounded. They're used to wrestling each other, and they're limited. And even though fans may prefer that, it's going to be a small group of fans that will support that.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Some stiff comments there from Rob Van Dam, who posted that as part of an audio blog that went up a few days ago. Obviously referring to TNA with those comments without naming them specifically, talking about the organization, some of the talent down there. I'm sure that those comments will probably not sit well with a lot of the guys who work down south. And I'd be curious to find out what you guys think. Do you agree with RVD? RVD basically referring to TNA as obviously small fries, for lack of a better term. A lot of wrestlers down there competing, small fish in a small pond kind of thing, saying WWE talent is far superior. A lot of the talent down there, not as well-rounded, as he said, and limited, which I think is another word that probably will not sit well with some people. So be curious to get your feedback if you guys think it's just RVD picking on his former employer, if there's some truth to those words. This is episode 288 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off SummerSlam edition, exclusively on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and you can, of course, always subscribe in iTunes. It is Sunday, August 18, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. We are going to get to SummerSlam predictions here. I'm trying to bang this out as quickly as possible before the show airs tonight on pay-per-view. So we'll get to SummerSlam and a whole bunch of other stuff. I just want to comment on a few things first. The WWE 2K14 video game, making a really big deal about it. They're promoting the hell out of that thing. And they actually made a big announcement earlier in the week, speaking of TNA and this new video game. We'll get to that a little bit later. But yesterday, on Saturday, there was a symposium held. There's been a whole slew of events taking place in Los Angeles this weekend as part of all of the SummerSlam festivities, SummerSlam Access. So they had this symposium hosted by Jim Ross, and a bunch of superstars were there, including Dolph Ziggler, Daniel Bryan, Paul Heyman was there, Mick Foley, Stone Cold Steve Austin, as well as the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, who apparently is back in the fold with WWE and has started to do stuff again for them. And after his performance here at this symposium, it could very well be his last event. I saw it last night. I kept hearing that Flair was in rare form at this event, so I went and I pretty much went through most of it. It's like an hour and 15 minutes. I didn't literally watch every single minute of it. But I saw enough of it to just come away thinking, wow, what did I just watch? I will say this in a train wreck kind of way. It goes off the rails maybe half an hour, 40 minutes in, and it is very entertaining. It was very difficult for me to kind of skip through it and not sit there and watch the entire thing. It is very entertaining, but at the same time, I can't help but think the way that Flair was coming off, he came off probably as, to a lot of people, being batshit drunk. But then again, it could just be Ric Flair, who I'm sure had a few beforehand, and it's just Ric Flair being Ric Flair. As funny as it may have been, I thought it was kind of embarrassing, to be perfectly honest with you. And I know a lot of these events are usually very by the book, and people probably like the fact that Flair shook up the script and didn't give a shit about what was going on and literally just took over the whole thing. Jim Ross at one point turned his back and just walked away, and they're all friendly with Flair. Steve Austin was laughing. Paul Heyman was laughing. If you watched it long enough, you kind of picked up on the fact that Austin and Heyman in particular, it was kind of nervous laughter after a while. Even Heyman had this look on his face like, God, will somebody step in here and shut this guy up? Flair just went off on a tangent about anything and everything. He brought up TNA at one point. He was bashing a whole bunch. I mean, he talked about WrestleMania 8 and how dumb it was not to go with Hogan versus Flair, and that's a whole discussion for a different day. He was telling random story. He told a story at one point about how he introduced Jim Ross's wife to him, and when Flair picked up on the fact that JR's future wife was interested in JR and not the Nature Boy, he was offended by this. He said obviously she needed lens crafters, just on and on and on and on. But it got to a point where it was just embarrassing, and the guy is, what, 61, 62 years old? I find it kind of sad, quite frankly. So the video should still be up. It is a gigantic train wreck. If you want to go check it out, probably worth it to do so. I think 2K Sports put it up. I'm sure if you look for the link, you could find it. So I just wanted to comment on that. The other big story of the week, Darren Young in the news. He was, I don't want to say ambushed, but he was approached at the airport by TMZ earlier in the week. He was waiting for his baggage, I guess, at the airport in L.A., and they just so happened to ask him about, being a gay WWE superstar. Not that they knew he was gay, but the question was about, there being a gay superstar in WWE, I think, or something like that. But the point is, Darren Young just very casually, out of the blue, seemingly without any planning or anything, and who knows, it is kind of a coincidence, I would say, that TMZ just happened to approach this man who was there by himself and just so happened to be gay when nobody else knew. But in any event, he came out and said, well, I'm gay, and I'm happy, and this and that. And it was a whole big deal. It's really been a publicity boon for WWE, whether they were expecting this, planned this. If you want to be cynical, you might believe that. But whatever the case, he's been all over the place. They flew him out to New York a few days ago to be on the Today Show, all the morning shows, evening shows, all the websites, even the newspapers here in New York had, you know, an item on Darren Young coming out. I did get a laugh, and let me just say this, you know, I say much respect to the guy. It takes a lot of courage to do what he did, because still in this world, and I think it's absurd still to have to say that today it's, you know, a courageous move for somebody to come out. It really shouldn't be a big deal, and to him it wasn't. He didn't play this up as being a big deal. There wasn't a big press conference to announce it. I mean, he's a journeyman guy. He's a mid-card guy on the WWE roster, even though it is kind of funny, in the TMZ story, they tried to paint him out. I think they had a line in there about how he's the first headlining wrestler to ever come out while still signed to a major promotion. I think their I mean, I know what they mean, but I think their definition of the word headlining as compared to mine and probably yours is quite the stretch. But again, it really shouldn't be a big deal. Still, you know, a courageous thing for him to do, because you never know how people are going to respond. People in the locker room, you don't know how the fans are going to respond. You know, fans in general, whether it's football, wrestling, whatever, they can be brutal when it comes to this stuff. And this is kind of uncharted waters in wrestling. I mean, yes, there have been other gay wrestlers that we've heard about. Obviously, Pat Patterson, it's been far from a secret going back to the 90s that Pat Patterson is a gay man. But what they're referring to is the fact that when Pat Patterson, I don't know if that Pat Patterson ever came out. I think people just kind of knew over time. He wasn't an active performer on the roster. So in that respect, it is kind of a landmark thing. You know, here's this guy who's 30 years old, arguably in the prime of his career, coming out. There really has not been another wrestler in a major promotion like WCW, WWE, TNA, that has done that before. So, much respect to him for that. You know, there's going to be people who are probably negative about it. Unfortunately, you know, that's just the world we live in. I'll keep my other comments on that to myself. I think I don't see it as being a big deal. I see nothing wrong with it. And the people who do, I think, just need to get over themselves. There have been other wrestlers also who were gay. Chris Kanyon, I see his name come up a lot. I think Kanyon actually pitched an idea to be the first openly gay pro wrestler on TV, but the idea never went anywhere. He actually claimed later on, after he was let go by WWE, that the reason he lost his job was because he was gay. I don't know that there's any evidence of that, but that was what he claimed at the time. Orlando Jordan was another one. I think he's, you know, bisexual or whatever. WWE never acknowledged it. I know they did in TNA. They incorporated it into his character. To the people who think that this may hurt his career, I don't know why you would think that. I mean, I find that laughable if you're talking about the way he's booked or a push, I mean, let's be honest, it's not exactly like he's being pushed right now. From my perspective, he can't go anywhere but up. I think WWE loves all this publicity that he's been getting because, again, they get to push this, rightly or wrongly, as the story of the first openly gay wrestler in WWE and respect and tolerance and all the Be a Star stuff and the anti-bullying thing that they... I mean, it just plays in perfectly, I think, to what the company would want. And, again, I'm not saying that this is the reason he came out, but if I'm Darren Young and you're a guy who's pretty low on the card in WWE and potentially expendable, let's say if the day comes that they need to do some spring cleaning. You know, we hear about TNA doing a lot of cost cutting. It's not like WWE hasn't tried to cut costs and let guys go also. If I'm Darren Young, coming out publicly the way that he did is probably the smartest move that he could have made. I mean, WWE would be insane to do anything to this guy, to cut this guy or punish him in some way. They'd be absolutely eviscerated in the media for doing that. So if anything, I think it's a nice little bit of insurance for the guy. And who knows, maybe they'll turn it into an angle and they'll actually do something with him. Total Divas. I wanted to bring up Total Divas here. I made it 3 episodes. I'm very proud of myself for making it that far. But this past Sunday, a week ago, for me, just too much. Just too much contrived nonsense. I know it sounds silly given that pro wrestling is contrived in and of itself, but still, even I have my limits. Apparently, I'm in the minority. This was the third straight week that Total Divas went up in the ratings. It did 1.7 million viewers last Sunday. And think about that. I think the highest rated episode of Impact ever in its existence did a number like that. And that was back in 2010. When they went head-to-head with Raw that first night. Remember, they had that 1 3-hour show. Hulk Hogan debuted. So, you know, it's no wonder with numbers like that, the E! Network has wasted no time in picking up the show for additional episodes. There's going to be 6 more episodes that they're going to make. The second half of the first season, they're not calling it Season 2. This is still part of Season 1, so my guess is all of the players will remain the same. They're not going to add any new divas unless there is a Season 2. It'll premiere November 17th for those of you who can't get enough of Total Divas. So the show's a big hit. You know, congratulations, I guess, go out to WWE. They've got a big hit on their hands. I hope Natalya continues to get more TV time out of it. Maybe Trinity will, too, of the Funkadactyl. She's a great athlete. Ariane, not so much. On this show, Eva Marie, I think, is fine as an actress from what little we've seen of her on Raw. I think she's atrocious. But maybe she'll get better. She could be the next big diva. Who knows? I say this for the second season because it's obvious there's going to be a second season at some point. They need to get AJ Lee on that show. I would definitely give it another shot, I think, if they got AJ on the show. I know Natalya and Tyson Kidd get married later this season. I think it's probably the big like season finale. So I might check that out. But for now, I'm tapping out. I am done with Total Divas. Monday Night Raw emanated from Sacramento, California, the go-home show to SummerSlam this past Monday. Let's run through some random Raw observations here, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Daniel Bryan and Wade Barrett had a match to open the show with Brad Maddox as the guest referee, and this was part of one of the big angles on the show. Maddox fast-counted Bryan and gave Barrett the win. That set up a later segment with Maddox and Vince McMahon, where he admitted that he made a mistake. He wanted to make up for it by being named the guest referee for the WWE title match at SummerSlam. And, you know, it's obvious in the story that either Vince put him up to screwing Bryan over in the match, or he did it because he thought that's what Vince would have wanted. Remember, you know, the Maddox character as GM is being pulled in 3 different directions here by each member of the McMahon clan. So Vince was about to make him the ref. Out came the son-in-law, Triple H, to appoint himself the guest referee for the main event at SummerSlam before he laid out Maddox with a pedigree. So Triple H has wormed his way into yet another SummerSlam main event. Last time we saw Triple H officiate a SummerSlam main event, officiate, I should say. I said officiate. That's not a real word. Last time we saw him officiate, there we go, a SummerSlam main event, he botched the finish and screwed over John Cena. This is all part of the story. He didn't actually botch the finish, but he screwed over Cena. And let's not forget, of course, Kevin Nash texted himself. Let's not forget that epic piece of storytelling right there. Then we got a CM Punk Kevin Nash feud that went absolutely nowhere because, as Nash claims, this is Kevin Nash's story about what happened 2 years ago, why he and Punk never had a match. He claimed that he was on Plavix. Plavix is a medication that you take for your heart, and he could not get clearance to do the match. And I'm not saying that's not true. It was a medical issue. Nash would not get clear. They would not clear him for the match. So there was no match. But Kevin Nash did get 3 power bombs on CM Punk on TV without Punk ever getting any retribution. Instead, they put him in there with Triple H, who beat him. Again, no rematch between Triple H and Punk after Triple H beat him. And then Triple H beat Kevin Nash, and Nash disappeared. That was the last time we saw him as a, I guess, kind of a full-time performer in WWE. I guess they brought him back for the... actually, no, that probably was the last time we saw him. He made his big Rumble return as Diesel that same year. So I'm calling it right now here on the Sound Off. Mark my words, whether it's next month or Survivor Series or wherever, Triple H will get his match with Daniel Bryan, and he will beat Daniel Bryan. Unless the idea is for Hunter to accidentally help Bryan beat Cena for the title, and then Orton tries to cash in, and Triple H ends up turning on Orton, or attacking him, I should say, and then helps Daniel Bryan retain the championship, making Daniel Bryan the modern-day corporate champion for the McMahons. That would mean a Daniel Bryan heel turn, which I still think would be insanely stupid right now to squander his popularity as a babyface. But, I mean, think about it. I talked last week about the lack of heels they have on the roster. Okay, I talked about how turning Sheamus once he comes back would be a good idea. Instead, they can turn Bryan at a time when they desperately need top heels. They could go in that direction. We've already seen this before. You go back to 1998, SummerSlam that year, ironically also involving Triple H. He beats The Rock in a ladder match to win the Intercontinental title. Rock, who had been a heel up to that point, suddenly takes off as a huge babyface. I mean, he never actually turned, but the fans kind of turned him. Just like they've done with Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan never had a babyface turn. Through his comedy and through his in-ring work, people just started cheering for him. And they loved doing the yes chant, and they got behind Daniel Bryan. It was nothing WWE did to turn him. The fans turned him, just like they did with The Rock all those years ago. And at the time, Steve Austin back in 98 was the company's top babyface. So all of a sudden, you've got a second hot babyface. There was a period of about 2 or 3 months there in late 98 where Austin and Rock were... I mean, Austin was still the top guy, but they were neck and neck in popularity. So what did they do? They turned Rock heel at Survivor Series, and they aligned him with the McMahons, and they made him their corporate champion. And it set up an easy foe for Austin going into WrestleMania the following year. Right now, John Cena is the top babyface. You know, I don't care if people boo him or not. He's still the top babyface in the company. He's in the Austin spot. And they still have CM Punk on the roster as the number two babyface. So I could see them doing it. I could see them turning Bryan, even though I wouldn't do it. Instead, you know, you've got the issue of Randy Orton and his Money in the Bank briefcase. I don't see Orton lugging that thing around for another few months. Actually, he did an interview this weekend with Sam Roberts, and he's in real life, he said he actually does not carry it everywhere he goes. Like at the house shows, he leaves it on the bus that he has. But still, on TV, seeing Randy Orton come out with a briefcase, I don't see him carrying that thing around for another 3 months or 6 months. Instead of turning Bryan heel and making him the corporate champion, why not Orton? You know, Bryan can win the title from Cena, and then Triple H goes heel by screwing Bryan, and he helps Orton win the belt. You know, Cena supposedly is having surgery very soon on that alien elbow of his. His elbow is really messed up. He's been taken off all the house shows. They advertised him for a house show this weekend, and he no-showed, so they think they were offering refunds to people. They're saving him for SummerSlam, and hopefully he'll be okay for the match. This is a big match for both guys, especially Daniel Bryan. This is the biggest match of Daniel Bryan's career, and it would be a shame if Cena was hurt and it in some way impacted the match. He is hurt, but hopefully he can hide the injury or protect the injury and go out there and have the kind of match that I think a lot of us are expecting him to have. But he's having surgery. I don't know if it's this week or next week, but he's going to be out. So, you know, Orton, let's say, finally goes heel wins the title, and then feuds with Bryan for a couple of months until Cena's ready to come back. So, and then there's another theory also, maybe Bryan doesn't win the title at all. Cena retains, Cena beats him, and then Orton cashes in on Cena. I like that there are a bunch of different directions that they can go with this in terms of who turns, whether or not Orton cashes in, and I know it's still going to be a kick-ass match, but I think adding Triple H to the mix makes this a weaker match. It makes it a weaker match because he doesn't need to be there. You're just adding another name to the match for no reason. He'll end up overshadowing John Cena and Daniel Bryan. He came out on Raw this week, and look, I've never been to Sacramento, so I'm sure it's a lovely city, but these people, for whatever reason, were going nuts for Triple H on Raw. If you like Triple H, that's fine, but I thought it was kind of messed up that you have John Cena in the ring, you have Daniel Bryan in the ring. Out comes Triple H, and all the crowd does is chant Triple H's name. And that's what you may run into at SummerSlam. You'll have Triple H chants during the match. And the biggest reason I think that this is a bad move is you're telling people before the match even starts, get ready for a fuck finish. You know, at least before, I really did think that there was at least a small chance we might have a clean or quasi-clean finish to this match. Now all people are going to be waiting for Triple H to screw up or screw somebody out of the championship. And I think that sucks. Yeah, it doesn't ruin the match or anything. It's still going to be an awesome match. I've been waiting for this match for a long time. I just don't see the need for this guy to be in there. We had the best Miz TV segment I've ever seen on this show Monday night. Not just because Bryan and Cena were so freaking good, but for the way that Daniel Bryan put Miz in his place right at the start. Miz was Bryan's pro, if you remember, on the first season of NXT. And so there's no love lost between their characters. Miz just would not shut up. He was stirring the pot. And so Bryan turned to him and told him that if he didn't shut up, he was going to punch him in the face. I would just give him the title for that line alone.
Give him the title. That's good enough for me. No, I'm not giving him the title.
And the fans cheered him when he said it. Some babyface Miz is. So he was relegated to background fodder for the remainder of this segment. This was all about John Cena and Daniel Bryan. Bryan drew attention to the fact that his new t-shirt is a parody of John Cena's t-shirt. And he said that Cena himself is a parody of wrestling. He sounded downright devilish with this promo, which is why I think there's a decent chance they may turn him heel at SummerSlam. They've been dropping little hints of him in his promos, acting more heelish, I guess, than not. Cena then cut the mother of all babyface promos. Maybe the best promo of his entire career, to be perfectly honest with you. The fans were behind him. He showed fire and emotion like I've never seen before. There were no silly jokes. There was no corny comedy. Just him explaining that he does what he does for the fans and for the Make-A-Wish kids. He shared a story of a Make-A-Wish kid and his father that he met that same day. The fans cheered him. One of our listeners, Gabriel, made this point in an email, and I do think it's a valid one. My one criticism of this, and his also, is that I feel like we've heard this all before. Like, you know, Cena always feels the need to try to explain himself every time he cuts a serious promo. And, you know, this is why I am what I am and why I do what I do. I'm not going to change who I am. I do it for that little brat in the front row with the snot bubbles coming out of his nose. You know, he doesn't have to constantly explain himself. We get it. Okay, you are who you are. You meet with the Make-A-Wish kids. We get it. So if I had one criticism of it, that would be it. He rattled off some of the biggest names that he's beaten. Triple H, Shawn Michaels, Batista, CM Punk, The Rock. He said Bryan is not as good as those men and never will be until he beats Cena and wins the championship. Bryan then talked about a custom that he learned while wrestling in Japan, where wrestlers would slap the shit out of each other as a way to fire them up and kind of light a fire under them. He said Cena is not a wrestler, and so he doesn't deserve to be slapped, which I thought was a great line. Cena slapped Bryan instead. This was just so great. Everything about this segment up to this point was money. And then out came Triple H. He was smiling for whatever reason, probably thinking, look at these two goofs arguing over petty nonsense. Don't they know I'm the one getting all the attention at SummerSlam? Randy Orton came out onto the stage. He raised up his Money in the Bank briefcase just to remind everybody not to forget about him. If you chop off the last 90 seconds or so, this was a damn near perfect segment. Speaking of Orton, he had a match with Damian Sandow in a battle of the Money in the Bank briefcase holders. Kind of a boring match. Orton won after a distraction by Cody Rhodes. Cody was on commentary, and he was just getting owned left and right by Michael Cole and JBL. At one point, they asked Cody if he were in Damian Sandow's shoes at Money in the Bank. Would he have done the same thing by pushing him off that ladder? And Cody responded by saying, yeah, I probably would have done the same exact thing. No wonder this face turn has been a bust so far. He's a heel. Now it all makes sense. We got a Shield promo backstage. Shaky cam was in full effect here, but that aside, I thought this was awesome. They complained about all the old guys still taking up space on the roster. Rollins and Reigns issued an open challenge to a tag team title match at SummerSlam. Ambrose talked about the Battle Royal to determine the number one contender for his U.S. title that was taking place on this show. He said, if Andre the Giant's ghost isn't in this Battle Royal, then I ain't losing at SummerSlam. As I said on Twitter, I could listen to Dean Ambrose promos all week long and twice on Sunday. They had a mixed tag match with Kali and Natalya, who are still together even though on Total Divas they're about to show Natalya and Tyson Kidd together, but whatever. They come out with Hornswoggle. Big E Langston and AJ Lee are their opponents. Big E and AJ have a match at SummerSlam. Kali and Natalya do not. Well, Natalya does, just not with Kali. I point this out because Big E and AJ lost this match after AJ tapped out to Natalya. Not only that, but after the match was over, Big E got laid out by a Kali chop. This made no sense. It's not even like they rematched them on SmackDown and they got their revenge and laid out Kali and Natalya. It didn't even happen. So the other thing about this is somebody botched the finish of this match badly. I think Natalya, AJ, and the referee were all responsible to some degree. You know, shit happens, it's not a big deal, but it looked really bad. Natalya had AJ in the sharpshooter, and then she just let go. And AJ, it looked like AJ tapped after she let go of the hold, so maybe she was a little late on the tap. Natalya just didn't realize it. Whatever the case, instead of calling for the bell and awarding the match to Natalya, the referee just stood there. Natalya went over to have her hand raised. The dude's just like, the match isn't over yet. So she went back and did the move over again, and AJ tapped out, and she won the match. Natalya, even then, kind of lost her grip on AJ's legs. This whole thing was just a complete clusterfuck. Hopefully it doesn't stall whatever small push Natalya may be getting. It's nice to see her get a win on Raw. It's just too bad it had to end like that. The referee, Mark Harris, he sure didn't seem to think he did anything wrong. He took to Twitter to respond to people telling him that he messed up. He said, the submission was released before the tap out, so I could not stop the match until the submission was reapplied. Good reffin'. No mistakes. Submission was released before the tap out, so it was reapplied until the tap out. A great ref would pick up on that, and I did. No problem. A lot of know-it-alls think they know the rules, but do not. That's why I'm a professional, because I'm one of the best. Well then, this guy seems to have an awfully high opinion of himself. And he's the best, apparently. Even though up until Monday night, I had no idea what this guy's name was. But he's the best. The world champion won a match on Raw. And I'm being serious when I say that. I'm not making that up. That really happened. Alberto Del Rio beat Kofi Kingston in a pretty good little match. Crowd was silent for most of it, but these guys worked hard. The Usos beat the Real Americans. Swagger and Cesaro, so the Usos are not dead just yet. Fans actually started a DUI chant towards Swagger during this match, but as many of you pointed out to me on Twitter, that could have easily been directed at Jimmy Uso as well, so point well taken. Fandango and R-Truth had a dance contest instead of an actual match when Summer Rae and Emma had their dance battle on NXT last week. It was entertaining enough. I didn't need to see it again here on this show. Fandango attacked Truth from behind while he was dancing, but he ended up getting sent out of the ring to the floor, and that was literally all that happened. That's it. It was basically a Fandango walkout finish, only there was no match. So I'm guessing the Cena-Bryan segment ran long, maybe this match got cut, but this was a complete waste of time. Then we got a 20-man battle royal, and actually both guys were back out there for the battle royal. This was to determine the number one contender to Dean Ambrose's U.S. title at SummerSlam. On the pre-show, this battle royal had one really cool spot involving Kofi Kingston and Antonio Cesaro, and a really hot finishing sequence. The spot with Kofi and Cesaro, Kofi basically got sent over the top rope by Swagger, and Cesaro happened to be out on the apron. So Kofi, on his way out, grabs Cesaro on his way down. He grabs him almost in a sunset flip position. Cesaro, though, was holding onto the ropes, and Kofi's feet barely missed touching the floor. And he's basically holding his own body weight up just by gripping Cesaro's thighs. So that was actually really cool. Mark Henry, Ryback, and RVD were the final three. Henry and Ryback had a stare down. The building was literally shaking. The hard camera was shaking. People were into this. Ryback got eliminated. That left Henry and Van Damme, two baby faces. Place was going nuts at this point. Henry had RVD out on the apron. He charged at him, which is always a bad move for a guy that big. Van Damme pulled the top rope down. Henry went soaring to the floor. So that's a great finish. Rob Van Dam wins the Battle Royal. Afterwards, the Shield came out. They surrounded Henry and RVD in the ring. When all of a sudden, the Big Show made his grand return, looking a lot slimmer. He did an interview this weekend and claimed that he lost, he went down from 460-something, maybe. I forgot what he said. He lost like 42 pounds, I think it was. So, it's like a complete lifestyle change. No more diets. Diets don't work. They're all bullshit. He just changed his whole diet, what he eats, what he doesn't eat, and he's looking pretty good. So whatever he's doing, he needs to keep doing it, because a guy who's in his 40s, as big as he is with the injuries and the knee injuries that he's had, the more weight he can lose, the better off he'll be. So the Shield ran off at this point. One of our listeners, John, on Twitter, suggested making it a 6-man tag with the Shield against RVD, Henry, and Big Show at SummerSlam, winner take all. This was before they went and did the 6-man tag on SmackDown. I like that idea, but only if the Shield wins. I don't want them losing their titles in a 6-man tag. On Friday, they lost. Big Show gave Ambrose the KO punch. RVD pinned him to build up their title match on the pre-show. So, at least in terms of Ambrose's belt, I think he's safe. I don't think the same can necessarily be said for Rollins and Reigns. Main event on Raw was scheduled to be Paul Heyman and CM Punk. Heyman came out. He admitted the whole thing was a ruse. He brought out the Beast, Brock Lesnar. They showed a video package. Heyman said if Punk wants him, it's going to have to be 2-on-1. Whatever happened to Paul Heyman saying that his client doesn't fight for free? Maybe I'm just imagining that. Punk's music hit. Nobody came out. Instead, he came out of the crowd. He grabbed one of the cameras from a cameraman at ringside. He nailed Brock from behind with it. He chased Paul Heyman. Curtis Axel cut him off. Punk ended up laying out Axel with the GTS and was left standing tall as the show went off the air. So, interesting observation I made when Raw ended. Punk has now ended the go-home Raw shows for both WrestleMania and SummerSlam, two of the biggest pay-per-views of the year, without being involved in the main event title match. If you remember, the Monday before WrestleMania, the closing scene of that show was CM Punk pouring Paul Bearer's supposed ashes on The Undertaker. And Punk-Undertaker was a big match being promoted for WrestleMania. I just didn't think that that would be the final image they would go off the air with. And they did the same thing here with Punk and Lesnar. Things didn't work out too well for Punk at WrestleMania. And I think he's in for more of the same, I think, at SummerSlam. And actually, let's just get to it right now. Let's talk really quickly about SummerSlam. Run down the card, give my predictions.
The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Guess what? It is Noah Mark and Brian
Blade. I can say my own name, douche.
All right, and we are hijacking once again the Solomonster Sounds Off.
This was your idea, not mine, Mr. Solomonster.
That's fine. We are live here at the Omni Hotel in Los Angeles, California. You can consider us your roving reporter here on the Solomonster Sounds Off.
Just what he wants.
I know. We're going to be quick, though, but we just thought we'd check in.
You're never quick.
From SummerSlam, we just met R-Truth. We just met
Rob Van Damn.
And I'm sure by now we have tweeted those photos at DJNoah80.
At Super Blade, but we really didn't, but we will soon.
Anyway, let's get right into it. We're going to give you our predictions whether you like it or not. First, let's talk about Punk and Lesnar.
Brock Lesnar.
Go ahead, real quick.
Oh, Brock Lesnar. He should win. He's bigger. Punk's a twerp compared to him.
I'm going to go with CM Punk.
Why?
Because he's got to get his hands on Paul Heyman. That's the payoff.
He'll still do that the next night.
No, we want to see it.
Stretch it. Stretch it out.
I want to see it at SummerSlam. I want to see him get his hands on what is it? That guy's name? Paul Heyman.
Stupid.
Yes, I want to see that happen.
Say something stupid. Wait, you always do.
Thank you very much. And, of course, the WWE Championship match. It's John Cena versus Daniel Bryan. Oh. What do you say, Brian Blade?
I want Daniel Bryan to win. That's all I'm going to say.
Is that your prediction?
Sure, why not? Yes!
All right, and I'm going to go with an offshoot prediction.
Hurry up.
John Cena wins,
yeah,
and Randy Orton cashes in.
I would love it if Daniel Bryan wins, Randy Orton cashes in, and then he beats his ass too, but that's wishful thinking.
All right, so there you go, Solid Monster. Back to you live from Los Angeles.
Yes! 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 Yes!
Think he's going to put this on the podcast?
No.
The preceding announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
What was that old Gorilla Monsoon line he used to have on Jimmy Hart? I think he used to call Jimmy Hart a walking advertisement for birth control. For some strange reason, that's what I think of whenever I hear those two guys. Time for my real predictions here. We'll start from the bottom of the card, work our way up. Rob Van Dam and Dean Ambrose for the United States Championship. It's taking place on the pre-show, the one-hour pre-show, so they've expanded it. And I guess I spoke too soon on Sound Off 287 when I said at least they're not booking title matches anymore on the pre-show. The rumor had been RVD and Antonio Cesaro in a match, and then sure enough, they go and announce a championship match for the pre-show. So, silly me. Supposedly they're going to shoot some sort of angle during this match or after this match that will then lead to Mark Henry and Big Show against Rollins and Reigns being added to the pay-per-view. I'm going with Dean Ambrose here. I don't see him losing the championship, nor do I see there being a reason for him to lose the championship. He needs to be in there, I think, with somebody of RVD's caliber to elevate him a little bit more. He hasn't exactly had that many really outstanding opponents, so I think a big win over RVD would go a long way for Ambrose. Plus, as I understand it, and again, nobody really knows except RVD. It's been kept very hush-hush, the kind of contract he has with WWE, but I have heard that it's a deal where he works for 90 days and then gets time off. So he'll work the first 3 months. He's already been here for a month. He's got two more months left to go. And then RVD may well disappear for a couple of months. Doesn't mean he can't win the title and then lose it in a few weeks. I'm just saying it's not as though he's going to be around necessarily straight through for the next several months. So I see no reason for him to win the championship here. And as far as Rollins and Reigns against Show and Henry, if they do that match on pay-per-view, you know, I would hope that the Shield retains, but I got to be honest with you, I could see Henry and Show winning, so I'm going to go ahead and say Henry and Show. If they have that match, I think we're going to have new tag team champions. Natalya and Brie Bella. I guess this is the Total Divas match. Maria Menounos, there was some talk about her maybe wrestling in a match on this show. Instead, she is doing a match this afternoon at Fan Access. The reason, I think it's her and Natalya against the Bella Twins or Brie Bella and a partner for choosing, because I think Nikki may still have an injured foot. I assume this is just being filmed to air as part of those new episodes of Total Divas that E! Just picked up. So Maria Menounos relegated to Access, but Natalya and Brie Bella are supposed to have a singles match on the pay-per-view. I'm going to go with Natalya here. Not that it matters, but she's my pick. Dolph Ziggler and Caitlyn against Big E Langston and AJ Lee. I'm going to go with Big E and AJ just because, if for no other reason, Big E and AJ got squashed by Kali and Natalya on SmackDown, on Raw, I should say. And that made absolutely no sense to me, so perhaps they're just going to go over here on the pay-per-view. And poor Dolph Ziggler. You know, the guy finally reached the pinnacle. I guess the pinnacle would be the WWE title, but he won the World Heavyweight title. I was in the building that night. I had the privilege of being there in New Jersey the night after WrestleMania, and I can't really point to too many experiences I've had at live events where the crowd reacted the way they did from the moment Dolph walked out and cashed in that briefcase to the moment he won the title. It really was. I don't know that Dolph Ziggler will ever have another moment like that in his career. He can win as many championships as they want him to win. I don't know that he'll ever truly have a moment, aside from maybe being in a WrestleMania main event, that will match what happened to him in April. And he won the title. He defended it for all of a few weeks. Then he got kicked in the head by Swagger that time on SmackDown, got the concussion, and was in a bad way for a while. He basically has done not much of anything since. You know, he came back, his first match back, he lost the championship to Del Rio. They did the double turn, so he's a babyface now. And, you know, he's having a better time, I think, than Cody Rhodes is. Cody Rhodes has had more of a tough time, I think, getting over as a babyface than Dolph has. But Dolph just has done nothing. And it's not his fault, necessarily. They've just done nothing with him. So he hasn't... You know, I figured by SummerSlam time, he'd be back in the hunt for the world title. Instead, they have Christian in there. And Dolph is relegated to a mixed tag match that I think he's going to lose on the pay-per-view. So I'm just it's quite a fall from just a couple of months ago. Kane and Bray Wyatt in a Ring of Fire match, not an Inferno match. The object here is to pin your opponent or make him submit. I'm not saying nobody will be set on fire, but that's kind of not the point of a Ring of Fire match. I'm going to go with Bray Wyatt. It's his first match, his debut on TV inside the ring. Hell of a way for him to make his in-ring debut against Kane, a former World and WWE Champion on pay-per-view in a fire match. But the Wyatt family, so far so good. They're doing well with those guys. Kind of like they did with the Shield at first. Now the Shield has kind of cooled off a little bit. But from what I understand, the Wyatt family is Triple H's new little pet project. And this is Bray Wyatt's first match. Kane is going to be going off soon to go film a movie. I see no reason for Bray Wyatt to lose this match, so I'm going to go with him. Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow. I'm going to go with Cody Rhodes in this match. The best explanation I can offer, Damian Sandow has the briefcase, so of course he'll lose. Go back and look at how they have traditionally booked the winners, Randy Orton aside, how they booked Daniel Bryan after he won the briefcase, how they booked Dolph Ziggler after he won the briefcase. Ziggler had that one big win over John Cena at TLC last year when he had, you know, AJ turned on Cena and aligned with Dolph, but by and large, when you win the briefcase, I guess maybe in their mind, since you've got this thing, they can make you lose, and it doesn't matter because you have a briefcase. I think I don't agree with that, but I'm going to go with Cody Rhodes. Damian Sandow has the briefcase, and for that reason, he'll probably lose. World Championship on the line, Alberto Del Rio and Christian. Christian has been on something of a win streak of late. He beat Damian Sandow on SmackDown. He's beaten Del Rio a couple of times on TV. I think they've done a good job of building him up as a credible challenger. But his run is about to come to an end. So my vote goes to Alberto Del Rio to retain. CM Punk and Brock Lesnar, the best against the beast. That's the marketing for this match. I'm going to go with Brock Lesnar in this match. I see... I don't know, you know, who the odds makers are favoring. I haven't checked out any of that yet. But Brock Lesnar is a guy, his record is not exactly sterling since he came back to WWE. His first match back, he lost to John Cena. Then he beat Triple H at SummerSlam. Then he lost to Triple H at WrestleMania. Then he beat him in a cage. I mean, most of this guy's matches have been against Triple H. It's no wonder I'm sick of seeing Triple H in the ring. So now Brock finally has a new opponent. The stuff with him and Heyman and Punk on TV these last... you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks, whatever, has been some of the best stuff on TV. It really has been. And it's kind of a shame that this feud has to come to an end. I don't see Brock Lesnar and CM Punk being rematched at the next pay-per-view. In fact, from the sounds of it, Brock Lesnar after SummerSlam, I mean, maybe he'll be on Raw the next night, but after SummerSlam, Lesnar is gone probably until WrestleMania. I don't think Brock is even supposed to be doing the Royal Rumble. So he's going to go away for quite some time. You know, you could say, well, then CM Punk should win because Punk's going to be around, Brock isn't going to be. But you're going to bring Brock back, let's say, for a match with The Rock or a match with The Undertaker or WrestleMania. You need to keep him strong. Brock should not be losing matches like this. And you could do a match where Brock Lesnar wins, even if, you know, there's cheating involved. Brock Lesnar wins the match. He's my pick. I still think CM Punk gets his hands on Paul Heyman after the match. With Brock winning, if he wins, you know, you can have, it's almost like a consolation prize. Yeah, Punk lost, but in the end, what is everybody really paying money to see? If they're paying money for this match, they're probably paying money to see Punk get his hands on Heyman, at least in theory. That's the way they've built this up. Heyman always runs away like the little sniveling little weasel that he is. So Brock wins, and then, you know, Punk gets the last laugh at the end of the match and gets his hands on Heyman. And you can keep the feud going with Punk and Heyman. I don't see any problem with Punk getting his hands on Heyman at SummerSlam. I don't think it's too soon. I think they've done a good job of keeping them apart. So maybe he gives him a GTS or something. That doesn't mean that the feud is over. Brock may go away, but then maybe Heyman, you know, brings in a new Paul Heyman guy, or they want to push Curtis Axel so it becomes a, a Curtis Axel CM Punk feud. I mean, they could do whatever they want to keep it going, but Brock's my pick. Main event, John Cena, Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship. I'm going to go ahead and predict that Daniel Bryan wins the WWE Championship. Randy Orton will then cash in, not at SummerSlam, or maybe he'll try to, but in the end, he'll actually cash in on Raw the next night in Anaheim, and he will win the title from Bryan the next night on Raw with an assist from Triple H. That's my pick. There's a lot of different scenarios you could go with here, and believe me, I'm a big Daniel Bryan fan. I followed his work for a number of years, even before he came to WWE. Part of me would hate to see him win the championship finally for the first time and lose it 24 hours later, or even worse, lose it the same night and only hold it for a few minutes. But to me, just him winning the championship, if it happens, is you know, validation enough. It would be a really cool moment, I think, for Bryan Danielson fans to see him win the title. And if he loses it, it's not as though he's going to be pushed right back down the card. I don't think he's going to get the Dolph Ziggler treatment, you know, if you know what I mean. I think he's in the main event now. He's in the world title hunt at least for a few months, especially if Cena goes out with an injury. Well, he has an injury with surgery. You know, you need somebody else on top to feud with Orton, or for Orton to feud with in the form of Bryan. So I think Daniel Bryan as a main eventer for the foreseeable future is here to stay, and that's a really cool thing. And I do think he's going to finally have his big moment at SummerSlam, and it's going to be a glorious moment. The only regret that I have is when I originally agreed to go down to Philly and I joined Noah Mark and Brian Blade for Money in the Bank last month, I did so largely because I was under the impression they were doing Cena Bryan the first match at Money in the Bank. And I desperately wanted to be there for this match. And the crowd in Philly that night was electric. I'm a little worried because, I don't know, you know, these Los Angeles crowds for SummerSlam in the past have been hit or miss. We could get a really hot, awesome crowd at the pay-per-view tonight, or we could have a crowd that, quite frankly, is garbage. And it would be a real shame for Cena and Bryan to be in there and have a crowd that just doesn't really care, or they're more interested in chanting for Triple H. I mean, it could ruin the match, and I think that would be a shame, and I'm sorry I'm not going to be there for it. That's my only regret. I think it would be really cool to be in the building for this match. So that's the SummerSlam card. I guess we'll find out how I did next week and how those other two goofballs did with their predictions as well. NXT, this past week, got some thoughts on that. I can't think of a better way for NXT to kick off this week than with a Paul Heyman appearance. Paul Heyman on the microphone coming down to the ring. Heyman says he's there to scout for a new Paul Heyman guy. Why not a Paul Heyman girl? I think he ought to give Paige a look. I think she'd be a great fit for his little stable there. He brings out Curtis Axel. He says that there is not a man in the state of Florida who could beat him for the Intercontinental title. And you knew that would not sit well with the guys in the back. Big E Langston takes offense to this. He comes out. It's still weird to me seeing him as a babyface here on NXT, but a heel on the main roster. He is infinitely more over as a babyface with the five-count gimmick. He challenges Axel to a match, and for the second week in a row, we've got ourselves a major championship. Well, I mean, depending on your definition of major, I guess, but a major championship being defended on NXT. Last week, it was the U.S. title with Dean Ambrose and Adrian Neville. This week, it's the IC title, and actually, next week, AJ is defending her Divas title against Bayley. So that'll make it 3 weeks in a row. At one point during this match, Axel was being dragged away from the ropes by Langston, and he's kind of clawing at the ring skirt, like just clawing for his life, trying to hold on. And if you have OCD, it probably was driving you nuts whenever they do that. They kind of mess up the banner that's hanging outside the ring. The banner was like all messed up and kind of crumpled, and it wasn't straight. So Paul Heyman fixes it, and the crowd bursts into a chant of, "Thank you, Paul." That was awesome. Langston was about to hit his finish, the big end. Heyman ran in, nailed him from behind for the DQ. A very Bobby Heenan-esque Paul Heyman, I think, over these last several weeks, only without taking the bumps that Bobby Heenan used to take, which is good because those bumps royally fucked up Heenan's neck. So I don't think Paul Heyman needs to be taking too many bumps at this point. Actually, I remember when Heyman was with Brock Lesnar, and they had the feud with Big Show. And, I mean, Lesnar and Big Show back in, like, 02, 03, more so 03, they were having matches every single week at TV, on the road, and it was the same thing every night. Heyman would end up taking an F5 every single night from Brock Lesnar. And ask anybody who's ever wrestled Brock Lesnar, and even Brock himself will tell you that he can be rough in the ring. And I just remember reading how all three of those guys were so totally fucked up. Brock was hurting, Big Show was just in pain every day, Heyman was hurting, and every single night, every week, they would go out there and work together. So Heyman does not need to be taking bumps anymore. He laid out, Langston did, he laid out Axel after the match with the big end anyway, and did his own five count. Sami Zayn is backstage with the lovely Renee Young, who is stunning, by the way. For some reason, she also doesn't seem to ask questions that are nearly as stupid as, say, Josh Matthews would, so I can actually tolerate her a lot more as a backstage interviewer. Sami Zayn said that he and Antonio Cesaro each have a victory over the other, so why not settle it once and for all next week? He challenges him to a 2 out of 3 falls match, so there can be no debate about who the better man is. You got to win 2 matches in one night to prove that you are the best. This is the match I asked about last week. I've been waiting weeks for this match, and I am very excited to finally see it. I can only hope that it lives up to expectations. Everyone's been raving about how awesome it is, and the problem with that is you hear how awesome something is for so long that when you actually see it, it's entirely possible that I may come out of this match underwhelmed. Something tells me I'm not going to come out of this match underwhelmed. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. Mason Ryan beat Scott Dawson in a quick squash. I pretty much hated everything about this. It's not often I crap on something this much on NXT, but I hated this. Sylvester Lefort, whose character I kind of liked when I first saw it, he is just completely boring to me now. They should just let him play the French Stallion character that he portrayed on Lance Storm's reality show. He did this reality show called World of Hurt a couple of years ago. It aired on some obscure men's channel up in Canada that none of you probably saw. I only saw it because I downloaded a few episodes online. That was the only way for me to find it. But on that show, he was awesome. You know, he's a Frenchman, obviously. He's got an accent, but it wasn't as over the top as he plays it up here on this show. And the guy, at least on the reality show, and again, reality TV is never exactly reality. He was just a total douchebag. He played the douchebag on that show so well. Everybody hated him. I think that could really work as a heel on TV. You know, they don't have to play everything up to the point of ridiculousness, which is what they do with his character here. I mean, on that show, he was an arrogant, believable prick. And in this role, he's going nowhere in this role. And he's managing a redneck character, which makes no sense. It's not working for me. And then Mason Ryan. I have now seen Mason Ryan enough to know that the dude still sucks. He looks so stiff and unnatural, even when he makes his entrance. Watch him. Watch his mannerisms when he comes out. And in the ring, I mean, nothing's really changed from the last time you all saw Mason Ryan on TV a few years ago. I mean, he can do some impressive power moves, and that's about it. Enzo Amore and Colin Cassidy, who he's been feuding with of late, they came out at the end of this match. They also got their asses kicked by Mason Ryan. This segment sucked. Paige defended her NXT Women's Championship against Summer Rae, the loser of last week's dance battle. We're told that Emma was injured after Summer Rae's vicious attack on her, you know, that one move that she did. Not for nothing, Summer Rae plays the role of bitch very well. She also trash-talks her opponents a lot as she's beating them up, which is nice. I always love me some trash-talking, so that's certainly a quality about her character that I like. She took a good portion of the match, too. She was beating Paige down. Paige started to fight back finally, and then kind of out of nowhere, she hit her Paige Turner finish and got the pin. Later, they showed a replay of Emma coming out after the match and attacking Summer Rae during the commercial break. My question is this, if she was well enough to do that, to come out and do the run-in, then why the hell couldn't she wrestle? Back to Renee Young again backstage. She's standing with the Divas champion, AJ Lee. AJ looks obnoxiously cute and happy here, until Bayley grabs her from behind. There's a big bear hug. Bayley plays the starstruck diva so well. I like her character a lot. AJ just looks completely creeped out by this girl. Bayley says that she followed AJ from her car into the building. She heard that she's going to be defending her title on NXT next week, and she asks if AJ would give her the title shot. And AJ agrees. Bayley is all excited. She says that she's not sure why people call AJ crazy. And, of course, you don't use the C word around AJ. Her happy demeanor quickly turned to one of anger. So not only will AJ be on the show next week, but we also learned that Dolph Ziggler will be appearing on NXT next week. They didn't say what he would be doing or who he would be wrestling, but he will be there. Main event was The Shield in a six-man tag against Xavier Woods, Adrian Neville, and Corey Graves. Real good match, as most Shield six-mans are. They won after Rollins powerbombed Xavier Woods against the turnbuckles in the corner, and Reigns finished him off with a spear. Obviously, there was a lot of action that led up to this point, but I'm not going to recap it all for you. You should really just see it for yourself. It's worth it to watch NXT each week. If you can, I would advise you to do it. The rumor is that they're actually trying to find NXT a home on TV here in the States, possibly a lot sooner than most people may think. I hope it's true. I know a lot of our international listeners probably have NXT where they are on TV. Here in the States, we don't. We have it on the Hulu Plus service. And we have not had NXT on TV since those crappy seasons of NXT when they did all the obstacle courses and the pros and, you know, the rookies and all that garbage. This show needed more Tyler Breeze this week. There wasn't enough Tyler Breeze. We have a loaded show next week, though. You got Cesaro and Zayn, 2 out of 3 falls. AJ and Bayley for the Divas title. Dolph Ziggler doing whatever it is that Dolph Ziggler does. Let's get to TNA here, because there was also some big TNA news that broke, actually, I believe it was on Friday night, and that is that Brooke Hogan was fired by TNA this week, the result of more cost-cutting by the company and the fact that her storyline with Bully Ray had pretty much gone as far as it could go. You know, realistically, once she went public with that real-life engagement, she kind of screwed the company over. You know, the storyline with her and Bully and the Aces and Eights and the marriage, it was effectively over at that point. And she was also the head of the Knockouts division on TV, but, you know, about a month or so ago, I think it was, maybe a month and a half on Impact, they had that segment where she came out and she nearly resigned because she felt like her presence there was causing too much chaos. So if they want, they can just go on TV next week and claim that, you know, Hulk Hogan finally granted her wish or something like that, just to kind of explain her absence. But I say good riddance. You know, I wish her no ill will, but she had no business being on TV. She brought nothing to the show. It was a move that was long overdue. And like I said before, unless the plan was ultimately to turn her heel and have her align with her husband and with Aces and Eights, and who knows how that would have turned out. I mean, Stephanie McMahon's heel turn turned out pretty well all those years ago, and I'm sure there were plenty of people thinking that she was a bad actress and it would never work. Unless they were going to go in that direction, she was dead weight. So her father is still with TNA. I see people posting online that they fired the wrong Hogan. He's still there. Everything seems to be amicable, so I don't foresee him going anywhere anytime soon. On Impact this week, Bully was backstage on the phone with who we were led to believe was Brooke Hogan, although he only said Brooke. He never said Hogan. If you do not want a spoiler for this Thursday's edition of Impact, I'm warning you now. Skip ahead a few minutes right now. Okay, that's my fair warning to you. We find out on this week's episode coming up on Thursday that the Brooke that Bully was on the phone with was actually Brooke Tessmacher, who makes out with Bully Ray in the ring. Apparently, they have a makeout session in the ring. So I guess that she becomes the first female member of Aces and Eights, if we just ignore that one tape pay-per-view show they did where Ivelisse Velez was used as a member of Aces and Eights. I don't even know when that show airs, but I imagine it'll be pretty confusing for a lot of people when it does. Also, with Brooke Hogan being gone, I guess Miss Tessmacher can now get back her name and not just go by Miss Tessmacher anymore. She can be Brooke again. Impact on Thursday night was a special Hardcore Justice edition. So basically, it's like getting a pay-per-view for free, or that's how they bill it. You know the show is hardcore because we get a viewer discretion warning at the very beginning of the program. Frankie Kazarian won a four-way ladder match for 20 points at the Bound for Glory series. He beat Austin Aries, AJ Styles, and Jeff Hardy. Chris Daniels and Bobby Roode did a run-in at the end, and he helped, both of them helped Kazarian win. Again, they're a little trio now, the three of them. Minor quibble I had with this match: lots of fake stalling. And I know it's something you get in pretty much every single ladder match, whether it's a title hanging from the ceiling, a contract, a briefcase, whatever the case may be. It's one of my little pet peeves whenever somebody's climbing. And yeah, there's got to be, I mean, there is a way. There are guys in ladder matches who do a good enough job of masking it and climbing the ladder in such a way that even though they're moving at a snail's pace, it kind of still looks believable. You didn't get any of that in this match. I mean, there were multiple occasions where there was somebody climbing a ladder fast. There was nobody else around to stop them. And as they're reaching for this contract, which is hanging down, you know, it's hanging vertical. It's like a clipboard. Very easy, you would think, to just yank that shit down. And they had to stall. They pretended they couldn't reach it. It just looks so phony to me. So that was something that kind of bothered me. It took me out of the match a little bit. I just happened to notice it more here than, you know, even like Money in the Bank last month. But good match. You know, these guys took a beating with those ladders. And in the end, Kazarian gets the points. Dixie Carter appeared in the ring with the Main Event Mafia. She explained that Kurt Angle has entered a rehab facility, and they do not know when he's coming back, but he has their full support. And she never mentioned what he was in rehab for, so for the TNA viewer who may not be aware of Kurt's issues with alcohol, they may well think he's in rehab for something else. Maybe he tore his quad and he's recovering from a leg injury. Who knows? It's a clever little way to be straightforward, I think, with the audience on TV, and not turn it into an angle, but yet still keep things a little ambiguous. Aces and Eights come out. Mr. Anderson said they have 1 week. Main Event Mafia has 1 week to find a replacement for Kurt Angle on their big five-on-five match. And the segment ended with Aces and Eights laying out the Mafia, including Rampage Jackson, by the way, who got beat down in the corner. So he was beaten down and selling and all that for the first time. ODB won a three-way knockouts match, beating Gail Kim and Mickey James. Mickey's title was not on the line. During the match, ODB tried to take off her bra to use it as a weapon, but she could not get it off. She was wearing, like, layers of clothing. I don't know, she was wearing, like, at least two, three different undergarments or garments over her undergarments for her boobs. And she's trying to pull this bra off, and it kind of got stuck. So she just, now the bra strap is hanging down, and she's just like, fuck it. She just lets it hang. She's choking Gail Kim with her bra strap. So I guess that was kind of innovative. But really, of all the knockouts I'd love to see use their bra as a weapon, I got to be honest with you, ODB is not at the top of my list. She drank from her flask. She spat whiskey or bourbon, whatever's in there, right in the champion's face, blinding her. And she pinned Gail Kim using Mark Mero's old TKO finisher onto a steel chair that happened to be laying in the ring. It's basically like a diamond cutter off her shoulders. So ODB getting the big push. Backstage, Sting went to go talk to Austin Aries about joining their team. Sting said, "We need you." Aries was about to give an answer. They cut to commercial. Later, upon returning to the Mafia's dressing room, Sting said that Aries had turned him down. And I gotta say, I really like that, and I'll tell you why. The fact that they would have Sting, you know, still one of the biggest stars in the company, Hall of Famer, go to Austin Aries for help. Even after he had already wrestled earlier in the night. You know, usually once you have a segment on the show, that's usually it. But Sting felt like he had to go to Aries. And then Aries basically told him to fuck off. So to me, it really makes Austin Aries look like a big deal. You know, certainly a bigger deal than the way he's been booked of late. So I like that. Rampage said they do have one other option. He was going to head to the ring. Samoa Joe went with him. So we get Rampage Jackson, who was wearing a camouflage suit, by the way. I have no idea where he got this suit from, but I want to know where he got it from because I want to get me one of those. He was given the chance to cut his own promo in the ring by himself for the very first time, and you know what? I thought he did a good job. All things considered, he did real well. He handled himself well. He called out Tito Ortiz to ask him to be the fifth member of the Main Event Mafia next week. They plugged their Bellator fight on pay-per-view November 2nd, which is the entire reason why these guys are even there in the first place. Ortiz said that he was the longest reigning light heavyweight champion in MMA history. I yawned. Who cares? Bully Ray came out. He called Tito a Huntington Beach bitch because, you see, Tito Ortiz is from Huntington Beach, California. So he's a Huntington Beach bitch. Rampage had to restrain Tito from going after Bully. That was really the whole segment. Tito never did say whether or not he accepted Jackson's offer, although we would find out later in the night the answer to that question. But it was a smart move on TNA's part to send Samoa Joe out there. He was just standing there, almost like an enforcer, in the background the entire time. And he was clearly there, just in case things started to go south. Because you had two guys in the ring cutting a promo who are not pro wrestlers. And this was their first time really in the ring cutting a promo, a long promo like that. You had Rampage and Tito, and so Joe is there kind of just as a backup in case things go awry. And they never did. Joe never had to say a word. Rampage, I thought, was real good here. Tito was okay. Bobby Roode won a four-way tables match over Samoa Joe, Magnus, and Mr. Anderson. So Bobby Roode gets himself 20 points in the BFG series. He's now in second place behind Magnus. Kazarian and Daniels came down to interfere on Roode's behalf, as Roode and Daniels did for Kaz earlier. Daniels splashed his apple teeny in Magnus's face, and Bobby Roode powerbombed him through a table. We had a commercial for No Surrender, so No Surrender is going to be the next big impact on September 12th in St. Louis. That's their next old pay-per-view turn free impact. Main event was Bully Ray and Chris Sabin in a steel cage for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship, Bully Ray regaining the TNA World title. The finish, as far as I'm concerned, the finish was telegraphed the moment they added that dumb stipulation about Bully Ray, if he loses, never again getting a title shot. You know, WWE pulls that same crap. I don't understand why they do it. Is it really adding that much intrigue to the match? Do people really give a shit about that? It's like when CM Punk and John Cena had their big Money in the Bank match 2 years ago. Punk's contract was expiring. The story heading into the match was, would Punk win the title and take it with him? That's a big enough hook for that match without Vince McMahon going and adding the stipulation that, you know, if John Cena didn't win, he'd be fired. As though anybody would even believe that. And Cena did lose that match, but he never got fired. So they make you feel cheated by ignoring their own stipulations. Now, I'm not a wrestling promoter, but some friendly advice from a fan. Stop overdoing the stipulations. Thank you. Anyway, there was a ref bump towards the end. Sabin hit a missile drop kick on Bully. He got the visual pin, but there's no ref. So he tried to escape the cage, going through the door. Anderson ran down. He slammed the door into Sabin's head or shoulder. I think it was his shoulder. Rampage and Tito come out. And all of a sudden, Tito Ortiz whips out a ball peen hammer and whacks Rampage in the back of the head with it. So down goes Rampage. Inside the cage, Bully nails Sabin with a bully bomb, gets a three count in the title. So Tito Ortiz is the newest member of Aces and Eights. And so ends the Chris Sabin experiment, or maybe I should say project. Project Sabin over. It's nice to see them try to get over new stars, but the dude is not a world champion. Just nobody took him seriously as one. And since I may not be able to watch Impact next week, I went and read the spoilers for next week's big 10-man tag. So, again, if you don't want to hear about what happens this week on Impact, skip this part. Okay? You've been warned. The fifth member of the Main Event Mafia turns out to be AJ Styles, who is apparently back to his old gimmick and his old theme music, which is good news for him because this new gimmick was just killing him. Fans didn't know whether to cheer him or boo him, so now at least they're making a declarative statement. This man is a babyface. He is on our team. So Main Event Mafia and Aces and Eights, the man who took the losing fall and must leave TNA forever, D-Von. Now, originally, I figured they would do the Tito Ortiz turn on that show, and he would cost Rampage the match, but the D-Von thing actually makes sense to me after something I heard this week. Do not be surprised to see D-Von end up back in WWE the early part of next year. That's all I'm going to say. Don't be surprised. Hulk Hogan was in the news this week, although probably not the news TNA was hoping for. Take Two, which is the company now that has the WWE video game license, they made the announcement that Hulk Hogan, both as the Real American Hogan and the NWO Hollywood version, will be part of the new WWE 2K14 video game this fall. He and Andre the Giant will both be part of the game's 30 years of WrestleMania theme. And some people may be wondering, well, how is this possible? You know, Hulk Hogan works for a different organization. How can you do this? Hogan has a deal with TNA that allows him to make his own outside merchandising and licensing deals. So just like in WCW, and later when he returned to WWE, he had, you know, full creative control worked into his contract when I'm sure nobody else probably did. Maybe Bret Hart did. He had some kind of stipulation. I think in the last like 30 days he had full creative control. But Hogan has always had full creative control over his shit. And he's Hulk Hogan, you know, he can get away with that. But still, it's embarrassing for TNA to have the face of the company, which is what Hogan is, even though he is 60 years old, sign on to be part of a big video game. And the big video game and the big advertising blitz that goes with it is for the opposing promotion. It's just really embarrassing. It's not good publicity for TNA. It's not. I know some people may think, well, it could be good for TNA. You know, one of their guys is getting the rub. Really? How does that benefit TNA? How does that bring in new viewers for them? How does that make them money? It does nothing for them. Hogan was part of, I think, one video game for TNA, and it bombed. I think he was in that game. I know Hogan has his own video game that came out a while back that just looked completely stupid. It got ripped apart, I think, in reviews. I know, you know, you would think that one of the things TNA could benefit from by bringing Hulk Hogan aboard would be making money off their own video game with him in it, with Hogan's likeness. WWE talent in these video games, they make a shit ton of money off the video game. So you would think that signing this guy to a contract and bringing him over 3 years ago, one of the main things was, we've got to get a big video game out, and Hogan can be part of it, and that can really help us bring in some money. That should have been one of the main reasons they brought this guy in the first place. And instead, he's going and making money for himself and for WWE for a video game for them. Hey guys, Solomonster here. As many of you know, I am a proud contributor to the Layfield Report, a website brought to you by Michael Cole and the longest reigning WWE champion in SmackDown history, John Bradshaw Layfield. There you'll find all the latest news and opinion from the world of professional wrestling, business, politics, sports, and more. Even better, you'll find me. You can show your support for my work there by scrolling down and finding the latest blog hit rankings on the right-hand side. Then, click on the name Jason Solomon, that's me, for a list of all my latest work. The more people who read these columns, the better, so be sure to share with your friends on Twitter and Facebook and help show your support for the Solomonster and the Sound Off. This week, I talk about why it makes sense that Randy Orton will soon be WWE champion again and a theory on when it may actually take place. Read all about it exclusively on the Layfield Report. Go to layfieldreport.com right now. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. And as I mentioned each week, we also accept audio questions if you want to send. MP3 format only, give or take about 30 seconds. And if you send in an audio file to be played on this show, please also include your question in written form in the body of the email that you send. Christopher writes in, if WWF had triple threat matches back in the day, how big do you think a match would have been between Hulk Hogan, the Ultimate Warrior, and the Macho Man? I think that would have been huge. But you know what? In a way, I'm happy that we did not get to see that, because I think it may have made those matches somehow feel a little less special. There's something to be said for how big those singles matches were. You know, Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior at WrestleMania 6. And Warrior vs. Savage, Hogan vs. Savage. You stick all three of those guys in the ring together, and I don't know, it almost doesn't feel quite as epic. It's so weird to think back on the lack of three-way and four-way matches back then, just because we're so used to seeing them now, they're so commonplace. This question comes from Danny. In the whole Stephanie McMahon Triple H storyline in 1999, do you think it would have made more sense to have Test be the one to wrestle Triple H instead of Vince McMahon? After all, Test is the one who got shafted, and having him face Triple H could have elevated him. Well, we can't have that now, can we? We don't want to elevate the poor guy, God forbid. Vince McMahon was more over than Test was at that time, and you know, maybe they just figured that match would draw better on pay-per-view, but I agree with you. You know, Test was hot at that time. He was over. That SummerSlam match with Shane McMahon, the love her or leave her match, that really helped put him on the map. And after Triple H ruined their whole wedding ceremony on Raw, it would have made complete sense to have Test get revenge on Triple H at Armageddon the next month on pay-per-view. And you could still do the Stephanie turn at the end of that match. The match can play out the exact same way. If anything, you probably will get a better match out of it because Test is a wrestler. Vince McMahon is not. At the time, Vince McMahon was the 50-something-year-old owner of the company. Test was over. He was on fire. He had some really good matches around that period. And he and Triple H could have been the ones going out there for 20 or 30 minutes having a hardcore brawl. And you do the same thing at the end with Stephanie turning on him instead of turning on her father. After that, you could keep everything as is. You do the Triple H Cactus Jack street fight at the Rumble, which is really what solidified Triple H's position in the main event. You know, he made a believer out of me after that match, and I think a lot of other people as well, that, okay, this guy now is a main eventer. Because I got to be honest with you. I mean, just from my perspective, up until that point, or maybe the very end of 99, but I think even it was the Rumble match that put it over the top for me, I never really saw Triple H as being a main event guy. You know, you had Austin, you had Rock, you had Foley, Undertaker, even Kane. Those guys were on a different level. And Triple H was just kind of being, you know, pushed as a main eventer. I don't want to say shoved down our throat, but it took, I think, that match with Foley was the first time that I really saw him as, you know, wow, okay, this guy, I can believe this guy is as a main eventer now. It doesn't feel like, you know, they're just putting a mid-card guy in a main event match. So I wouldn't want to change that. I think that Rumble Street Fight is one of the best matches in Rumble history. I certainly wouldn't change that. And, you know, you then have him defend the title against Rock at WrestleMania in a singles match. That's how I would have done it. Rock and Triple H was one of WWE's all-time great rivalries, and I can't believe that we never got a singles match between the two of them at WrestleMania. We got three Austin vs. Rock matches, but not one Rock vs. Triple H match at WrestleMania. We just got that four-way with a McMahon in every corner, which, you know, it came down to Rock vs. Triple H, so they did have, you know, a while by themselves to wrestle in that match, but it was still a four-way match. A four-way match with a completely bullshit finish. Vince McMahon beat The Rock with a chair shot. Not exactly the way that I would have hoped to see a match with Rock and Triple H at Mania. So I think that's kind of a shame that we never got to see that match. Brian from Dundee, Scotland. I recently watched the, ironically enough, Rock vs. Triple H match, the Iron Man match from Judgment Day 2000. Was the outcome originally planned as a Triple H win? Undertaker seemed late with his entrance, and it looked like a slightly botched finish. The outcome went as planned with, Triple H winning the title, but the time cues got all screwed up at the end. It looked like Undertaker was supposed to nail the tombstone, then Shawn Michaels, who was the guest referee, would call for the DQ, but they ran over. If you go back and watch the end, first of all, Rock vs. Triple H, the Iron Man match, in my opinion, very underrated. I don't want to call it the best Iron Man match of all time, because I don't think it's the best necessarily, but I don't think that match gets enough credit. Those guys went out there, they had almost the opposite of the kind of match that Bret and Shawn had. This match was more action. This match, I think, ended 6 falls to 5. They didn't do the whole, you know, both guys are tied with no falls going into the overtime period. It was all action, the crowd was hot, and yeah, the finish was kind of a cluster of all these different people running in and tons of interference. When Undertaker came back, this is the debut of the American Badass character. Go back and watch the end of that match. It was like the last 40 seconds or so. And, I mean, the place is just coming unglued. You have all the McMahon-Helmsley people in the ring. DX is in there. You know, X-Pac, Road Dogg, Vince, Shane. Undertaker, Biker Taker comes in. He's beating the crap out of everybody. He's chokeslamming people left and right. He punched Vince McMahon hard way in the face. I think he broke his nose because Vince came up bleeding. And you could kind of tell that things were going a little long. And it's funny because when Undertaker grabbed Triple H by the throat to chokeslam him, it was good that Shawn Michaels, you could clearly see that Shawn Michaels saw it happen. He probably should have just called for the DQ at that point. They had a timer on the screen in the corner counting down the seconds that were left. And Undertaker is not done. He gives the throat slash, so he's going to give him the tombstone. And when the clock hit, I think 4 seconds, whoever in the production truck took that clock off the screen deserves a raise. I don't know if it was Kevin Dunn or one of his lackeys or whatever. Somebody had the foresight at that point with 4 seconds left or 4 point, whatever the hell it was, to take that damn clock off the screen. Now, even after they took the clock off the screen, it was obvious, okay, way more than 4 seconds has passed. Where's the buzzer? Where's the bell? And they just reached a point, it felt like, where, okay, we can't bullshit this anymore. Undertaker has Triple H up for the tombstone, hasn't dropped him yet. And then the buzzer goes off, and Shawn Michaels all of a sudden is like, oh, ring the bell, ring the bell. But, you know, thankfully, they took that damn clock off the screen, because otherwise, if it would have counted down to zero, that would have been even more embarrassing. So, yeah, I think everything just went kind of long. You know, and you could say, oh, it was a fuck finish, whatever, interference. To me, it worked in this situation from the action in the ring, the crowd reaction, the big Undertaker comeback at the end. I thought this was a really, really good match that just does not get the credit that I think it deserves. Ray Vaughn from New York City, what Royal Rumble match do you think was the worst of all time? Worst of all time. Wow. You know, the first Rumble was only 20 guys, and it was the first, so I don't want to call that the worst. And, you know, I'm kind of a nostalgic guy when it comes to, like, wrestling in the late 80s, early 90s. I kind of loved all those Rumbles, so I can't really say that any of those were the worst. If I had to pick a Rumble that was the worst, I'll be perfectly honest with you, I probably would have to go with 1999. As hot as they were at that time, and I love the Austin versus McMahon feud, they made it all about them in this match. Vince came out and Austin came out, numbers 1 and 2. They started the match out. Very hot start. Austin just kicking the shit out of McMahon. But the problem is that, literally, as other people came into the match, everything else in this Rumble was filler. There were no little side stories like you normally have. You look at most Royal Rumble matches. There's usually a guy, maybe two guys, but usually one guy who it's obvious this guy's winning the Rumble. Okay? That's usually how it works. And there's like a main story. So maybe, like in the case of Austin in that Rumble, Vince announced that I'm going to give $100,000. I'm putting a bounty on this guy's head for the man who eliminates Austin. I think that was in 99. Maybe they did in 98. It was either 98 or 99. I think it was 99. But in any event, it doesn't matter. The point is, there's that one main story. But usually there's other little side stories. In 92, the story of that Rumble was Ric Flair coming in number 3 and lasting until the end and getting his ass kicked the whole time. And he would, you know, he had so many enemies at that time. Everybody wanted a piece of Ric Flair. So he'd fight off one guy. He'd fight off the Boss Man. All of a sudden, the buzzer goes off and here comes Roddy Piper. Ah, shit. And Piper goes after Flair. Hogan goes after Flair. Everybody was going after Flair. But you also had the side story of Randy Savage and Jake the Snake Roberts, who were in a bitter feud at that time. And Jake is out there, and the buzzer goes off, and here comes Savage. And they had like a, not a wide shot, but they had like a picture-in-picture kind of thing where in one little box, you saw Savage running to the ring, and the other box was like an aerial view of the ring. And as soon as Roberts sees Savage coming out, he slips out of the ring under the bottom rope and hides. He's bent over hiding on that side of the ring so Savage can't find him. And so that was a little side story they had. And you can pick other Rumbles with similar types of things. This one had none of that. It was all Austin and McMahon. They had, you know, almost half the Rumble, it felt like, was spent outside the ring. Austin got beat up in the bathroom by the corporation. He was laid out there. You know, it was just Vince bails, Austin disappears after him, and every other person who came down, nobody cared. And it didn't even really feel like a Royal Rumble match to me. And then, you know, with Vince winning, and you knew he wasn't going to go to WrestleMania, obviously, it was just a very underwhelming Royal Rumble. So I'd probably have to go at 99. Theodore Bond. It's an interesting name. He says, if this past year's WrestleMania, there were rumors of The Click going into the Hall of Fame as a group. Shawn Michaels is already a Hall of Famer, and you can easily make cases for Triple H, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and even X-Pac to get solo inductions, given the fact that you have people like Coco Beware in the Hall of Fame. Well, yeah, let me just stop you there. That's not really fair, I don't think, to use Coco Beware, to use the Coco analogy with these guys. I think all of these guys deserve their own inductions, even if they didn't put guys in like Coco Beware. You could definitely make a case for X-Pac, for Hall and Nash, no matter what you may think of them, and politics and all that BS. I would say if you were going to put somebody in like you know, Skimp of the Body Donnas or something, that would be kind of ridiculous, and you can make the Coco Beware analogy, but I think these guys are deserving of it, so I don't think that's really fair. But anyway, back to Theodore's email here. He says, my main problem with the Click being inducted as a group is that they were never a group on TV, only behind the scenes, and it just seems like an excuse to have each member in there so that one day they can become a two-time or even three-time Hall of Famer. When you think that both DX and the NWO will likely be inducted as a group one day. What are your thoughts on the Click being inducted into the Hall of Fame as a group? I don't like the idea, mainly for the reasons that you outlined here. All of those guys deserve to be inducted solo, I think, for their accomplishments. And then you add in the news that, you know, WWE is supposedly looking to induct DX as a group next year, including China. I think it was Mike Johnson of Pro Wrestling Insider. He first reported this a few months ago. I think they would be insane to try to do business with that woman, but you know, she was an important part of the original DX. So let's assume that DX headlines the Hall of Fame next year. You have to think the NWO at some point will be inducted, especially if Hogan ever gets back in the good graces of WWE. I'm sure Hogan would love to be a two-time Hall of Famer like Ric Flair. So now you're going to induct the Click? It just doesn't make any sense. The Click was a group of guys who worked together, traveled together, stuck up for each other behind the scenes. Politically, they had a huge impact on wrestling, both positive and negative. It was more of a behind the scenes thing, true, but I don't want to say that that's the reason I wouldn't do it, because I'll just give you an example. Jim Johnston works behind the scenes for WWE. Does that mean that Jim Johnston does not deserve to be inducted because a whole bunch of people would have no idea who he is? Of course not. Jim Johnston absolutely deserves to be inducted for all of his work over the years with all of the theme music and just everything he's done for that company in terms of music and what it has done for people's characters. It's become such an important part of the overall package of what you see every week on TV. It's almost a crime he's not in the Hall of Fame already. I don't think working off TV really matters, working behind the scenes. So I would induct them, just not as the Click. And if you want to do a DX induction, then fine. Do it after you induct Triple H first. I think it's so silly to think that you're going to induct Triple H into the Hall of Fame and have him give a speech and the whole nine yards, and then after that, you put him in as a singles guy and have him make another big speech. Just do it like Flair. He went in on his own, and then later they put the Horseman in, and he came back for the second induction. To do it the other way around just sounds ass backwards to me.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, a lot of SummerSlams taking place this week in history. First, 25 years ago this week, August 12, 1988, Owen Hart made his WWF debut under a mask as the Blue Angel at a house show in Oakland, California. He pinned Barry Horowitz in that match. Obviously, by the time he made his debut on TV, he was the Blue Blazer, which is the same character he was portraying the night he died 11 years later. 17 years ago this week, on August 13, 1996, WWE held its ninth annual SummerSlam pay-per-view from the Gund Arena in Cleveland, Ohio. This was the SummerSlam where Todd Pettengill hosted a beach party on the pre-show, the free-for-all. They had a swimming pool set up, and they did a deal where T.L. Hopper, the wrestling plumber, because back then, you know, times were tough. Every wrestler had to have a second job. We had a plumber, we had a dentist, a garbage man, a hockey player. It's no wonder I almost stopped watching that year. So T.L. Hopper retrieved what appeared to be a turd at the bottom of the pool and proceeded to eat it. And I guess it turned out to be a candy bar instead. At least I hope it turned out to be a candy bar. Gives new meaning to the term eat shit. On this show, Mankind beat The Undertaker in the first ever Boiler Room Brawl when Paul Bearer turned on Undertaker, ending their six-year partnership. He aligned himself with Mankind. Also, Shawn Michaels pinned Vader in the main event to retain his WWE Championship, which Vader actually won the match twice, first by countout, then by DQ. Each time the match got restarted per the demands of Jim Cornette, who was Vader's manager at the time. This is officially where the Vader character died in WWE. When he failed to win the title at SummerSlam, which I remember reading at one point had been the plan when this match was first conceived, I think the original idea was that it would be a vehicle for Vader to win the championship and go over as this big monster heel. Plans changed. That did not happen. And he was pretty much done for at that point. I mean, less than 2 years later, the guy was on pay-per-view calling himself a fat piece of shit.
I'm nothing but a big piece of shit. A big fat piece of shit.
In Japan, the dude was a monster. Early on in WCW, he was a monster. In WWE, he was just a joke. 14 years ago this week, August 14, 1999, WCW held its final Road Wild pay-per-view from the biker rally in Sturgis. On this show, Macho Man, Randy Savage, beat Dennis Rodman in a singles match, and Hulk Hogan, in the main event, where else, pinned Kevin Nash with a leg drop in a retirement match. And you all know how that goes. 2 months later, Kevin Nash was back. 9 years ago this week, on August 15, 2004, Randy Orton defeated Chris Benoit at SummerSlam to become the youngest world heavyweight champion in WWE history, a fact they were more than happy to push, because Brock Lesnar, who had left the company only a few months earlier on not the best of terms, had been billed previously as the youngest champion before Orton was. Next night on Raw, Orton beat Benoit a second time, and then he was promptly excommunicated from Evolution, and they wasted no time in having Triple H beat Orton to take back the title only a month later. 6 years ago this week, on August 12, 2007, TNA held its Hard Justice pay-per-view, which featured a main event of Kurt Angle against Samoa Joe in a winner-take-all match. Angle at the time was the TNA World Champion and the IWGP Champion. I think he'd beaten Brock Lesnar for the title. Joe was the X Division Champion and the TNA Tag Team Champions. Yes, he held both tag belts by himself. Please don't ask me why. I have no idea. They did a swerve where Karen Angle turned on Joe and helped Kurt win. He nailed Joe with a chair shot to the head and pinned him. So Kurt had all the titles. And this show also featured the TNA debut appearance of Adam Pac-Man Jones. And Adam Jones, who still plays in the NFL, was able to reach a deal with TNA because at the time, he was serving a 1-year suspension from football for violating the player conduct policy. He was involved in a very well-known incident at a Las Vegas strip club earlier that same year where he was making it rain, as they say. And he was throwing, I guess, a lot of $1 bills on stage at the dancers. One of the dancers went to pick up the bills, and he allegedly grabbed her by the hair and started slamming her head down on the stage. And security got involved. There were witnesses who said that Jones threatened to shoot one of the club's bouncers. One of the men returned to the club later on that night and started firing shots. And some of those shots ended up hitting the club manager, whose name is Tommy Urbanski, who, get this, was a former pro wrestler. He was pretty much a journeyman wrestler. He had one tag match with WWE back in the 80s against George Steele and Junkyard Dog. He had a ton of matches over in New Japan Pro Wrestling. He even teamed with a young Scott Hall in some of them. He was left paralyzed from the waist down after the shooting. He's confined to a wheelchair now to this day. And Jones claims he didn't know the shooter, and the club's owner says he did know the shooter. So there have been other incidents with him since then. So naturally, TNA decided it would be a fantastic idea to sign this man and bring him into work pro wrestling. After allegedly being involved in an incident that resulted in a former pro wrestler being shot and paralyzed. Nobody in that company thought that it might be a bad idea to associate ourselves with this guy. So there he was in the ring. He's being interviewed by Mike Tenay. Ron Killings, R-Truth, came out. They interacted on the mic a little bit. He tried to come after Pac-Man. Security stopped him. So naturally, these two later became TNA Tag Team Champions together, even though Pac-Man was not allowed to get physical in any way, as per his contract. So they bring this guy in, even with all the shit that was hanging over his head, all the baggage. They know that he's not allowed to wrestle. They put a title on him anyway. One of their belts they put on him. And they have Consequences Creed, who is the current Xavier Woods in NXT, wrestle on his behalf as a surrogate. And then in October, they decide not to renew his deal, and so Pac-Man retires from the ring. There's TNA, everybody. There's TNA. 3 years ago, August 15, 2010, SummerSlam featured a main event of Team WWE, led by John Cena, against the Nexus. This was the night whatever momentum the Nexus had was killed dead. It came down to 2-on-1, Wade Barrett and Justin Gabriel against John Cena. Barrett even drilled Cena with a DDT on the exposed concrete outside the ring. He ripped up the mats, the padding outside the ring, and he DDT'd Cena on concrete. And a few minutes later, Cena fought back. He beat both men on his own. He won the match for his team. And, you know, when I think back to Justin Gabriel while he was in the Nexus, I can't help but wonder what might have been with that guy. Barrett would always order him to the top rope whenever they would do those gang attacks. And he would set up for that 450 splash, which was over. I mean, it's a great move to watch. Obviously, the fans are into it. And, you know, he would sometimes have this very apprehensive look on his face. Like, he didn't really want to do it. I'm pretty sure that when they beat up the Legends, it was the same thing. And he didn't want to do it, but Barrett told him to do it, so he felt he had to. And I always envisioned things boiling over one day with Gabriel standing up to Wade Barrett. Or maybe one day he's up on the top rope and Barrett is telling him to come down for the move. And Gabriel thinks about it, maybe looks to the crowd and the people are telling him not to do it. And instead he jumps off and attacks Barrett. Or something along those lines. I just think he could have been a big babyface for them. Like a real solid mid-card babyface, like Intercontinental or U.S. level. And they never really did anything with him. He's stuck on superstars. Daniel Bryan, who had been fired from WWE after famously choking Justin Roberts with his tie during that initial Nexus invasion on Raw. One of the all-time great Raw angles, by the way. They fired him because choking was not allowed on TV. I think some higher-up executives may have complained about it. They were very sensitive to that sort of thing, and they still are after the Benoit tragedy. But there was always the understanding that we know there was no malice. We know you probably didn't know that it was a rule since you were new. Go away for a little bit, let this simmer down, work some indie shots, and then we'll bring you back in a couple of months. And that's what they did. Cena introduced Bryan as a surprise member of his team, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention that on this show, Alicia Fox defended her WWE Divas title against Melina. Yes, Melina versus Alicia Fox. This must have been the match that Cameron of the Funkadactyls was talking about on Tough Enough when Steve Austin asked her about her favorite match of all time. It's not quite Mick Foley watching Snuka come off the cage at the Garden, but to each their own. 2 years ago this week, on August 14, 2011, WWE held its SummerSlam pay-per-view from Los Angeles. On that show, Mark Henry and Sheamus had a match. Daniel Bryan and Wade Barrett had a match. Randy Orton and Christian were involved in a match. Triple H was the guest referee for the main event. You see the picture I'm painting here? This all sounds very familiar, doesn't it? The more things change, the more they stay the same, I guess. Christian and Orton had the feud of the year in 2011, as far as I'm concerned. This was one of the best matches the two of them had together. It was a no-holds-barred match, just awesome stuff. Orton won the title back. But he would drop it to Mark Henry the following month. That would kick off Mark Henry's first title reign. Main event was John Cena and CM Punk. Champion versus champion match to determine who the real WWE champion was. The undisputed champion. With Triple H as the guest referee. Punk gave Cena a GTS. Cena got his foot on the rope. But Triple H blew the call. He did not see it. He counted three. Punk was declared the champion. And as he celebrated, Kevin Nash emerged from the crowd like the cloverleaf monster coming out of the sea. He attacked Punk, left him laying with a jackknife powerbomb. Alberto Del Rio came out to cash in his Money in the Bank contract and pinned Punk to become the new WWE champions. That was 2 years ago this past week, and All I can say is I'm hoping for a very different finish to this match with Triple H as the guest referee than we got 2 years ago. If you have questions to send in for the mailbag or any other comments, suggestions about the show, anything like that, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You could also follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I'll be live blogging, live tweeting during SummerSlam tonight, Raw, every Monday night. It's always fun on Twitter, so follow me on there, @solemonster. And we're on Facebook as well. We're actually all over Facebook. The profile page is facebook.com/thesolemonster. Send me a friend request. And don't forget, we have a fan page that you can like, and we have a private group, a discussion group on Facebook. Just type in the full name of the show. You have to request access, and access will be granted, and you can be part of our little community on Facebook. Also, listen to The Sound Off each week on Stitcher Radio On Demand. You can do it on your desktop. You can do it on the Stitcher Radio app, which is free if you have iOS or Android. And everybody who streams the show via Stitcher is helping the show immensely as we climb the sports rankings chart. So you can listen to us on there. And you can also make a PayPal donation to the show. I want to give a big shout-out here, actually, to Dion over in Rotterdam in the Netherlands for his generous PayPal donation to the show. He'll be buying his first house soon. He has a lot of work that needs to be done, so best of luck to him. And also my thanks to Matt Isaiah for his donation to the show as well. If you would like to make a PayPal donation, the easiest way to do it, just go to thesolemonster.com. Check the right-hand side of the page. There'll be a little PayPal donate box. Whatever amount that you feel you want to or can contribute, every little bit helps. It is very much appreciated, so please visit our website and make a donation if you can. My thanks to Noah and Brian for offering their predictions for SummerSlam here with that little entry earlier. Hopefully, if you are checking out SummerSlam, I got some high hopes for this show, especially the main event. Hopefully it'll be one of the better ones. We'll find out. Until next time, this is episode 288 of The Sound Off. We'll be back for 289 next weekend. Until then, be well, stay safe. Those of you watching SummerSlam, do enjoy the show, and we'll see you right back here next week.
You've been listening to The Solemonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Daniel Bryan's been unstoppable!
The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello! Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? What the fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
Solemonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolemonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, The Solemonster Sounds Off.